And unconsciously, Mr. Kipling has proved this, and proved it admirably. For insofar as his work is earnestly understood, the military trade does not by any means emerge as the most important or attractive. He has not written so well about soldiers as he has about railwaymen or bridge builders or even journalists. The fact is that what attracts Mr. Kipling to militarism is not the idea of courage, but the idea of discipline. There was far more courage to the square mile in the Middle Ages when no king had a standing army, but every man had a bow or sword. And the fascination of the standing army upon Mr. Kipling is not courage, which scarcely interests him, but discipline, which is, when all is said and done, his primary theme. The modern army is not a miracle of courage. It has not enough opportunities, owing to the cowardice of everybody else. But it is really a miracle of organization, and that is the truly Kiplingite ideal. Kipling's subject is not that valor which properly belongs to war, but that interdependence and efficiency which belongs quite as much to engineers or sailors or mules or railway engines. And thus it is that when he writes of engineers or sailors or mules or steam engines, he writes at his best. The real poetry, the true romance which Mr. Kipling has taught, is the romance of the division of labor and the discipline of all the trades. He sings the arts of peace much more accurately than the arts of war, and his main contention is vital and valuable. Everything is military in the sense that everything depends upon obedience. There is no perfectly Epicurean corner. There is no perfectly irresponsible place. Everywhere men have made the way for us with sweat and submission. We may fling ourselves into a hammock in a fit of divine carelessness, but we are glad that the net maker did not make the hammock in a fit of divine carelessness. We may jump upon a child's rocking horse for a joke, but we are glad that the carpenter did not leave the legs of it unglued for a joke. So far from having merely preached that a soldier cleaning his sidearm is to be adored because he is military, Kipling, at his best and clearest, has preached that the baker baking loaves and the tailor cutting coats is as military as anybody. Being devoted to this multitudinous vision of duty, Mr. Kipling is naturally a cosmopolitan. He happens to find his examples in the British Empire, but almost any other empire would do as well, or indeed any other highly civilized country. That which he admires in the British Army, he would find even more apparent in the German Army. That which he desires in the British police, he would find flourishing in the French police. The ideal of discipline is not the whole of life, but it is spread over the whole of the world. And the worship of it tends to confirm in Mr. Kipling a certain note of worldly wisdom, of the experience of the wanderer, which is one of the genuine charms of his best work. The great gap in his mind is what may be roughly called the lack of patriotism. That is to say, he lacks altogether the faculty of attaching himself to any cause or community, finally and tragically, for all finality must be tragic. He admires England, but he does not love her, for we admire things with reason, but love them without reasons. He admires England because she is strong, not because she is English. There is no harshness in saying this, for, to do him justice, he avows it with his usual picturesque candor. In a very interesting poem, he says that, if England was what England seems, that is, weak and inefficient, if England were not what, as he believes, she is, that is, powerful and practical, how quick we'd chuck her, but she ain't. He admits, that is, that his devotion is the result of a criticism, and that this is quite enough to put it in another category altogether from the patriotism of the Boers, whom he hounded down in South Africa. In speaking of the really patriotic peoples, such as the Irish, he has some difficulty in keeping a shrill irritation out of his language. The frame of mind, which he really describes with beauty and nobility, is the frame of mind of the cosmopolitan man who has seen men and cities. Quote, for to admire and for to see, for to behold this world so wide, end of quote. He is a perfect master of that light melancholy with which a man looks back on having been a citizen of many communities, of that light melancholy with which a man looks back on having been the lover of many women. He is the philanderer of the nations. But a man may have learnt much about women in flirtations and still be ignorant of first love. A man may have known as many lands as Ulysses and still be ignorant of patriotism. Mr. Kipling has asked in a celebrated epigram what they can know of England who know England only. It is a far deeper and sharper question to ask, what can they know of England who know only the world? For the world does not include England any more than it includes the church. The moment we care for anything deeply, the world that is, all the other miscellaneous interests, becomes our enemy. Christians showed it when they talked of keeping one's self unspotted from the world, but lovers talk of it just as much when they talk of the world well lost. Astronomically speaking, I understand that England is situated on the world. Similarly, I suppose that the church was a part of the world, and even the lovers inhabited of that orb. But they all felt a certain truth, the truth that the moment you love anything, the world becomes your foe. Thus, Mr. Kipling does certainly know the world. He is a man of the world with all the narrowness that belongs to those imprisoned in that planet. He knows England as an intelligent English gentleman knows Venice. He has been to England a great many times. He has stopped there for long visits. But he does not belong to it or to any place, and the proof of it is this, that he thinks of England as a place. The moment we are rooted in a place, the place vanishes. We live like a tree with the whole strength of the universe. The globetrotter lives in a smaller world than the peasant. He is always breathing an air of locality. London is a place to be compared to Chicago. Chicago is a place to be compared to Timbuktu. But Timbuktu is not a place, since there at least live men who regard it as the universe and breathe not an air of locality, but the winds of the world. The man in the saloon steamer has seen all the races of men, and he is thinking of the things that divide men. Diet, dress, decorum, rings in the nose as in Africa, or in the ears as in Europe, blue paint among the ancients, or red paint among the modern Britons. The man in the cabbage field has seen nothing at all, but he is thinking of the things that unite men, hunger and babies, and the beauty of women, and the promise or menace of the sky. Mr. Kipling, with all his merits, is the globetrotter. He has not the patience to become part of anything. So great and genuine a man is not to be accused of a merely cynical cosmopolitanism. Still, his cosmopolitanism is his weakness. That weakness is splendidly expressed in one of his finest poems, the Sestina of the Tramp Royal, in which a man declares that he can endure anything in the way of hunger or horror, but not permanent presence in one place. In this, there is certainly danger. The more dead and dry and dusty a thing is, the more it travels about. Dust is like this, and the thistledown and the high commissioner in South Africa. Fertile things are somewhat heavier, like the heavy fruit trees on the pregnant mud of the Nile. In the heated idleness of youth, we were all rather inclined to quarrel with the implication of that proverb which says that a rolling stone gathers no moss. We were inclined to ask, who wants to gather moss except silly old ladies? But for all that, we begin to perceive that the proverb is right. The rolling stone rolls, echoing back from rock to rock, but the rolling stone is dead. The moss is silent because the moss is alive. The truth is that exploration and enlargement make the world smaller. The telegraph and the steamboat make the world smaller. The telescope makes the world smaller. It is only the microscope that makes it larger. Before long, the world will be cloven with a war between the telescopists and the microscopists. The first study large things and live in a small world. The second study small things and live in a large world. It is inspiriting, without doubt, to whiz in a motor car around the earth, to feel Arabia as a whirl of sand or China as a flash of rice fields. But Arabia is not a whirl of sand, and China is not a flash of rice fields. They are ancient civilizations with strange virtues buried like treasures. If we wish to understand them, it must not be as tourists or inquirers. It must be with the loyalty of children and the great patience of poets. To conquer these places is to lose them. The man standing in his own kitchen garden with fairyland opening at the gate is the man with large ideas. His mind creates distance. motor car stupidly destroys it. Moderns think of the earth as a globe, as something one can easily get round, the spirit of a schoolmistress. This is shown in the odd mistake perpetually made about Cecil Rhodes. His enemies say that he may have had large ideas, but he was a bad man. His friends say that he may have been a bad man, but he certainly had large ideas. The truth is that he was not a man essentially bad. He was a man of much geniality and many good intentions, but a man with singularly small views. There is nothing large about painting the map red. It is an innocent game for children. It is just as easy to think in continents as to think in cobblestones. The difficulty comes in when we seek to know the substance of either of them.